Chapter 16, Persuasive Advertising. Let's say you have $1 million tied up in your little company and suddenly your advertising isn't working and sales are going down. And everything depends on it. Your future depends on it. Your family's future depends on it. Other people's families depend on it. Now what do you want from me? Fine writing? Or do you want to see the goddamn sales curve stop moving down and start moving up? Rosser Reeves, Reality and Advertising. The next paragraph will make a lot of people mad, and it should. It should also make them think and help you earn more money. If it does nothing else, it will let you make an informed decision the very next time you create an ad. Far too few people understand what makes advertising persuasive today, and far too few business owners know how to understand if it is profitable. Most of the people writing copy and creating ads do not have a clue what makes ads work. I'm not talking about the people who work in big agencies, though many of them do not understand it either. I'm primarily talking about the people who create your ads. They're the guy at the newspaper or trade show magazine who throws your ad together, or the on-air talent on your radio who writes ads when she's not on the air and voices them too. They're also the frustrated directors who work at large ad agencies or small cable stations. It's the lady down in marketing who used to be the receptionist but over time was promoted to the marketing manager's position. And the technical writer who you promoted to be your copywriter because, well, he can write. These are the people who create advertising that rarely works, and it's your fault. You hired them. Now that you're hopping mad, let me tell you there is hope. None of those people have bad intentions. Quite the opposite, in fact. They want you to make money. So let us show them how. In this chapter, I show you a great formula for creating advertising that works. There are two steps to making your advertising persuasive and profitable. How to create profitable and persuasive ads. Number one, create ads that interrupt and tell a persuasive story. Number two, measure them. Rather than giving you a whole class on how to write the perfect ad or a long list of words that sell better than others, I'll do something even better. I'll give you the most carefully adhered to and most powerful copywriting principles you'll ever learn so you can apply them to the ad you're creating today. I'll show you how to get the information you must have to make your ads effective. These principles apply to print, radio, television, internet, signs, banners, direct mail, and even your on-hold messages. If you take these principles to heart and apply them to your ads and your marketing model, you'll be able to dominate your market faster, better, and at a lower cost than your competition. Before I go any further, I want to talk to you in more detail about why it is not a good idea to have your ads created by your ad representative or their team. Think of the sheer volume of ads that these people are responsible for creating on a daily basis. They're responsible for creating hundreds of ads a year, many of them for your competitors. Here's how it goes when the ad rep gets your ad. Either the ad rep or a copywriter in the office asks you for a few important points you want to get across. Almost always, these points are all about how good you are, your service, your hours, your convenient location. They also want you to throw in some special sale price that will help drive business. Then they go to work writing your ad. Put yourself in their place. Imagine if you were faced with writing a dozen ads a day for a multitude of businesses, some of whom are your competitors, some that require a great deal of thought, and some that should but are not going to get it. What would happen? Sure, you'd think hard for a few moments, then you would start thinking about all the other ads you wrote and pull the best phrases and ideas and offers out and put them together in an ad. Your ad. Is that what you really want? The result of this approach is predictable and typically not at all persuasive. What happens instead is that your ad sounds or looks just like your competitor's ad, which causes one of two things. Either it gets lost in the rest of the messages it is competing with, or it will reinforce your competitor's message if they have higher frequency and more consistent advertising than you. Along those same lines goes the idea of copying the ads that your competitors are creating or being all the places they are because that must be what works for them. The reality is that if you copy your competitor's ads, you only help reinforce their message. The most important thing you can do in an ad is to find your own message and drive it home. You have to tell a story that only you can tell. The chances of your real competitors knowing what the right thing to do with their advertising are very slim, and copying them is not a good idea when it comes to the message you're sending. The other problem with copying is that if their advertising is working and you do not have the budget that they do, or the same goals, it can be counterproductive. I want you to try this exercise quickly to see what I mean, and see how easily you can make your ads better and more engaging. Look at your current ads through a different filter, just for today. Suspend your beliefs about what is good or bad about your current ads and simply apply these principles to your ads and see how powerful they become. If you agree that your ads can change for the better, then you're on your way to increased business. If you cannot make your ads better, then congratulations. You've got one step of the process out of the way, or you're dangerously close to losing a tremendous amount of business. Here's what I want you to do. Get out your print ads, your TV ads, your website, your direct mail letters, your Yellow Pages ad, and your radio ads. Get them arranged so that you can work with them for just a few minutes. Now, I want you to replace any reference to yourself or your company with your competitor's name and logo and ask yourself this question. Would anyone know the difference between us if we switched logos or names? Also ask yourself, can my competitors say the same thing about themselves that I do about myself? Are you a little surprised by your answer? If in any category, most people can say basically the same thing accurately and factually, how hard does it become for a potential client to make a buying decision? Why would they choose you over your competition based on the information that you've just given them? Do you give up? So did your valued prospect. They settle for the first person who answers the phone or the question, or who has the lowest price. Now do you see why competition is so brutal in your category and why you've reduced yourself to competing on price? On the other hand, can you see how easy it can be to set yourself apart and compete on value instead of price? Before I give you the components of a good ad, I want you to keep some of the advice of Rosser Reeves, one of the nation's best advertisers ever, in mind. You must make the product interesting, not just make the ad different. And that's what too many copywriters in the U.S. today don't understand. Reality in Advertising, 1961. The operative word in that quote was the product. People do not want to hear all about you and how great you are and how great your business is and how lucky they are to do business with your exceptional employees. They want to know that the product you have will do what they need and that you'll be able to help them be sure that they have all the information they need to make a good buying decision. If they're first convinced of that, then come into your store and have the experience they expect, then and only then will they begin to believe your stories of quality service and employee superiority. Discovery, uncovery, the reality of you are all different ways of saying the same thing. If you want to know what is different about you, what makes people want to buy from you or will make them want to buy from you, you have to dig deep and find out what it is. You have to ask very detailed questions about your business, your product, your customers, your history, and yourself. Only after you've dug through all of that will you come up with your own uniqueness or your unique selling proposition, the one thing your whole story can be built around. Let me give you an example. I have a client called Fido Gear, www.fidogear.com. They make dog collars, coats, booties, leashes, and harnesses. Not all that remarkable, is it? Or is it? What if I told you Fido Gear was founded by a 70-year-old grandmother who loved dogs and wanted not only to do something in her retirement to stay busy, but also to help dogs? What if I told you that every single item they sold with the Fido Gear label was made by hand and it was made specifically for your dog from the measurements you send in? Now what if I told you that their products were priced the same as the ones you find at the local superstore? Are we getting somewhere, particularly as we build layer upon layer of why you would want their products if you value your pet? Uniqueness is what makes you who you are and what makes people come to you in a world of sameness. Here are some of the questions I want to ask you to find out what is unique about you. Tell me your story. How did you get started in this business and why this business? What are you passionate about in the business? What does the business do for you personally? Why have you chosen the products you have? What would people be shocked to know if they knew this about your business? What do your competitors try to copy of yours? What do you do for your customers that consistently pleasantly surprises them? Why do you do it? What problems are you solving for your customers? What frustrations do your prospects usually have when they're shopping for your product or service? How do you add value to your products or services that your competition does not or cannot? How do you know? When was the last time you shopped your competition? Tell us about your background. Why are you an expert in your business? If you're not an expert in your business, what would you have to do to become an expert? If you could only tell a prospect three things about your business and they would make a buying decision based on those three things, what would they be and how would they be different than what your competitors will say about themselves? Why specifically would they be making a good decision based on those three criteria? What do people have to hear every time before they'll buy from you? What are the three most common questions you get when people are trying to make a decision to buy? Who is your number one competitor and why? What is it that you know about your product or service that you wish people could just understand? Why is that important? By doing very detailed discovery with yourself and your employees, you get one level of information. Next, you do the same thing with a select group of clients, those people who are buying from you consistently, your good clients. In addition to the appropriate questions we just discussed, I want you to ask them these questions. You're a great customer of ours, and we want to attract more people like you. What makes us the first choice for X? Insert your product or service here. What do we do better than anyone else in our category? Why is that important to you? Could you imagine doing business anywhere else? If yes, tell me about that. If no, tell me why. Can you tell me the process that you went through in order to choose us? What do we do consistently that surprises you? What is unique about you that makes us a good fit for you? What could we do to make your experience here the best and most memorable experience you have ever had in this situation? Now you've added another layer of enlightening information from which you can create your most persuasive ad ever. But we will go one step deeper just to be sure we have gotten all the information we need. We'll go to a good customer who has quit using you or buying from you and ask these questions. What made you switch from us? What could we have done to serve you better? What is unique about you that we were not serving that made you switch away? Is there anything that could ever make you come back and be a client again? Can you tell me the process by which you chose your current supplier? Was there anything we did you wish your new supplier would do? How long did it take to make the decision to change from us to a new supplier? Is there anything that is not happening with your new provider that they could do that would make you happier? What would make you switch away from this supplier to someone other than us? With that final layer of complexity and answers to those questions, you end up with a tremendous pool of information from which you can pull some very surprising and powerful ideas, information, and stories that will be the basis for your uniqueness and for your ads, the kind of ads that grab people's attention. As a bonus, you also find out a lot of information that you can use to improve your service. Create ads that interrupt and tell a persuasive story. So what are the qualities of a great ad? The most important thing to remember about any ad, or any persuasive message, is that you're simply telling a story designed to gently interrupt, compel, persuade, and have the audience take some action. All great ads have a headline, no matter what the medium. The purpose of a headline is to interrupt, grab attention, and sell you on the very next sentence or idea. It must be something that hooks you and pulls you in. The goal of a great headline is to interrupt the general malaise that overtakes us when we experience ads on television, on radio, or in newspapers and magazines. The headline grabs us by the ears and speaks directly to us about what is important to us, or it grabs us by the eyeballs and forces us to read it, which compels us to read the next sentence. Persuasive ads focus on me, not on you. To earn my attention, you have to let me know, what is in this for me? If your ad cannot immediately set you apart from the competition in a way that makes me ask why I'm not considering you, it is not going to work. Great ads speak directly to the person you're persuading. They create a one-on-one conversation that tells a story, answers questions, and compels us to learn more or take action. Nearly all great ads ask a question relevant to me and then answer it. They include documented evidence of success, reliability, experience, and so on, and do not rely on unsubstantiated fluff statements like, ours is better than the competition. If you want them to believe you, transfer the power and credibility of someone I trust or someone who is like me to yourself so that I can trust you too. Exceptional ads give clients a real reason to believe what you are saying is true. They use third-party endorsements and testimonials to do their proving for them. No one wants to be the first one to dip a toe in your water. They want to know others have already dipped their toes in and pulled back a golden slipper, not a stump. Highly persuasive ads use words to allow us to create dynamic, beautiful pictures in our mind that include us in them. They speak to us on different levels. They get us involved, sensing, seeing, hearing, and feeling. If you want to really bring up memories that people have, ask them to remember what something smells like. When I ask you to think of new car smell, which car do you think of? If I ask you what it smelled like in your grandmother's house, I bet it takes you back. If I tell you that not properly drying your carpets after cleaning them will leave them smelling like a baby's dirty diaper, I bet you get a whole different picture. But did you see how easily a sense-like smell pulls you in and causes you to have an experience? Perfect ads not only set up criteria by which every competitor will be judged, but create a standard that only you can meet. Great ads set you apart from your competition. When you can put their name or logo in place of yours and say there is no way that they can say this about themselves, then you've got an ad that has a real chance of being successful. It is imperative that your ads make use of words, images, and phrases that put me in the picture, that demonstrate something I can understand that has happened or that I am afraid will happen to me if I don't use this product or service. Great ads are clear, succinct, and free of jargon or trendy words that many people may not understand. They must also have a binding quality, something that ties all these ideas together congruently. It will also tie it to your mind so that you know what you are hearing or seeing and who it is. This is where branding begins to occur over a long period of time. Another quality great ads have is a single focus that is driven home over and over again through any medium where the prospect may experience it and not changed until a new campaign is started. You must always remember the purpose of advertising is to sell something to one person at a time. Finally, great ads focus on one idea or action item per ad. If you have 10 things to say, you say it in 10 separate ads. Be sure every ad has a call to action that tells your prospects what to do next. It is imperative that you spend time focused on writing, rewriting, and researching your ads to get them perfect. But writing and rewriting is not enough. You must be able to determine their effectiveness in creating new customers and new revenue. If they're not doing either, then you must discard them and try again. If the bar is not moving higher, your ads are not working. I want to leave you with a few last tips for creating good ads. Be sure that your ads have a rhythm, like a song or a poem, that they have a beat, a feel that compels you and takes you on the ride with them, that encourages you to continue and keep the pace. Many times I find that when I'm writing ads, it helps to listen to music as it reminds me of pace and rhythm. In visual media, the words create the rhythm for the visuals, and the visuals are harmonized with the message to create a powerful outcome. I encourage you to look at a lot of ads to begin to find that rhythm and feel, and see how you can incorporate it when you create your own ads. If you've never written an ad before, here are a couple of books that will help you get started, and that will also help you better evaluate ads that others write for you. David Ogilvy, Ogilvy on Advertising. Dennis Higgins, The Art of Writing Advertising. David Morrell, Lessons from a Lifetime of Writing. Here's a good concept for you to keep in mind. Great ads can be created inexpensively, and expensive ads are not always great. Unless you're a professional graphic artist or production person, get some professional help to have your ads look and sound their very best. The only award you need to worry about your ads winning is the 6-inch Ben Franklin Award, the one that fits nicely in your wallet or bank account. If you're not coming up with the answers you need or the ads that work, make the investment to hire someone who can create the kinds of ads that will work. You'll easily recover any amount of money you invest in ad development through ads that pull better and bring in more paying customers than ever before. Measure your ads' effectiveness. The ultimate measure of how well your ads are working is how much more business you have this year over last. But there are other benchmarks that you should use as well. When measuring dollars, you should measure every day, week, month, and year. By measuring in this method, you can predict trends and know when your advertising is effective and when something is not working. It also gives you feedback you can use to make your ads even more persuasive. Traffic to your store or calls to your business are good indicators of how responsible people are to your message. Keeping track of traffic counts year over year is a very simple way of determining what is happening when you start a new campaign. Documenting an increase in sales of a particular item or service being advertised is an effective way of determining ad effectiveness. If you intend to focus ads on the sale of one product or service, it must be either a large enough sale that the campaign remains profitable, or you must have add-on sales that make the overall sale large enough to justify the campaign. If you increase the effectiveness of your marketing, many times you'll see close ratios increase dramatically. This happens for a couple of reasons. People are reminded that they wanted to buy your product or service and finally take action, or those people who are on the fence are moved to action because you gave them newer compelling information that caused them to take action. Using specific toll-free numbers or telephone numbers to track an ad, particular landing pages on your website, or special offers segmented by media can be effective in helping you better determine how effective your advertising is in a particular media. This is a lot harder to do with a small budget, but can be done. You simply present a series of ads on radio, for example, and then evaluate what happens over the period that they run. Then, move your ads to another medium and test again. There are inherent problems in this kind of test. One medium may be very effective at targeting instant buyers, while another has more impact with buyers over time. Another problem is how well targeted one medium was over the other. However, if you're testing an impulse or instant purchase, this can be an effective means of measuring. If you're going to use a testing methodology like this over the long term, you need to test a campaign over at least one quarter before you move to another medium and test there. Asking is probably the most common form of tracking and the least accurate for a number of reasons. First, most people do not remember where they heard about you first, if at all. That accounts for all the people who told you they heard about you on television when you've never been on television. People try to be helpful, so they guess. If you're going to ask, you have to ask for specific information. What station did you see me on? Which yellow pages do you use? What radio station do you listen to? Asking is somewhat more effective with print, where you can put an identifier in the ad that you can ask them about that would indicate which ad generated the response. The most important thing to remember about tracking is to do it. Tracking is one of the most critical components of making your business grow and for creating more persuasive ads. There is no substitute for good information to help you make better decisions. If you're not tracking, start today, and you'll be instantly more profitable as a result. Through this chapter, you learn not only how to make your ads more persuasive, but how to quantify whether they're working. By simply taking the time to review the results of the effort you expend, you'll be able to make your ads more persuasive and put a monetary value on the messages you're sending. Chapter Review. Persuasive ads are stories well told with a moral that involves the audience taking some action. Persuasive ads tell me one thing at a time. They do not try to cram too much into one exposure. They make a point and drive it home. Persuasive ads make use of nearly all the persuasion tactics you have learned throughout this book. Success questions. What can I say conclusively about my business that none of my competitors can say about theirs? Who is my audience and what is the story I most want to tell them? In reviewing my old ads, what can I see that should be done differently in future ads to make them more effective? Are the right people creating the messages I want our company to send? Chapter 17, Persuasive Negotiating. In business, you don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate. Chester L. Carras. For many business people, negotiation is one of the hardest and most misunderstood tasks they'll ever be called on to do. Just the simple thought of the word negotiation for many brings on one fear, that they might lose. Negotiation, when done appropriately, should leave no one a loser. Everyone should feel as if their needs were met or that the right thing was done. In my experience, the only negotiations that were not pleasant were those where one side, either rightly or wrongly, felt that the other side was taking advantage of them. Often, when negotiating, people fall victim to their prejudices, and rather than making well-founded decisions, they begin to make irrationally emotional decisions. Many times, those decisions are based on irrational beliefs, or even hidden beliefs that most people do not believe they have. There is a great tool on the internet at www.implicit.harvard.edu. That's www.implicit.harvard.edu. That allows you to test your prejudices about a number of things, including race, sexual orientation, weight, disabilities, and many more. It is very interesting to see what you consciously versus subconsciously believe about some things. It is often our unconscious prejudices that keep us from achieving what we want. We do not even see the roadblocks to our success because they are buried within. In order to be a persuasive negotiator, you must have congruence within yourself. You must also maintain a very clear idea of what an appropriate and acceptable outcome would be. Far too often, people start their negotiation process with unrealistic or unachievable goals. When that happens, no amount of persuasion will result in a more successful negotiation. In fact, quite the opposite will happen. More conflict will arise and parties will become more emotional. Finally, everyone is left in a position where they have to defend their unreasonable position and no one can win. Describing negotiation as win-win is the politically correct way of discussing what outcomes should be. Reality, on the other hand, is quite different. Everyone who sits down at the negotiation table has one goal in mind, to get the best deal possible for himself or herself. With that in mind, it's important for the superior persuader to understand that he or she can attach no emotion to other people's outcomes. One can only focus on creating an outcome that allows the other person to feel at the conclusion of the negotiation that the outcome is exactly as desired or at least acceptable. Victory truly does come when both parties' needs are met, but in some cases, one person will walk away feeling like a winner and the other like she did not get what she wanted. What has to happen when other people walk away not getting what they wanted is for them to understand and agree with the reason for the conclusion. If they do not, often they will break the agreement and the process has to start again or move to a different level. When thinking of negotiation, I think Robert Estabrook summed it up when he said, "He who has learned to disagree without being disagreeable has discovered the most valuable secret of a diplomat." Virtually all of the tactics of persuasion that you have learned earlier in this book apply here. The overriding consideration you have to keep in mind when you're hoping to get someone to give you some concession is, what do I have to offer in this deal? If you have nothing to offer, it's not a negotiation at all. It's simply a job of selling, and you need to take that approach. Negotiation by definition requires give and take. You have to know what you stand to lose and what you're willing to give up in order to protect it. Many times, for professional persuaders, the end of a selling situation requires some negotiation. Often, it is terms or margin or even the commission the salesperson earns that will be on the table. To begin the negotiation process persuasively, you must enter the process from a position of power and authority. That means being fully informed. You must know hard and fast facts about what can and cannot happen. You must know which items are flexible and which are immutable. You must also know which ones can be traded off, for example, longer warranties for payment up front. Once you know what your boundaries are, you need to do a little research on the boundaries of the person across the table from you. One of the things I suggest you do early if you know that a negotiation is imminent is to talk to other suppliers or people who have negotiated with the person or the company in the past. See if you can find out what his style is, find out how flexible he is, and find out what concessions he has made. By doing that, you begin to get a feel for how you can present your case and what to expect in return. The more prepared you are at this stage, the less bluffing can occur. Openness and honesty are critical keys to developing rapport and trust when the process is opened. You must ensure your persona matches not only that of the person that you're working with, but that of the person you will be negotiating with. If, for example, you've been working with a corporate real estate manager up until the point of negotiation, and for the purpose of the negotiation you'll be speaking with her attorney, adjust your persona. Be sure your clothing is on the same level as hers. Be sure that you're prepared ahead of time with a list of ideas and expectations that you're ready to discuss. Negotiations should only be undertaken by two people who have the authority to agree on decisions at the table. If you're not meeting with a decision maker, it is to your significant advantage to wait until you can. Not letting a decision maker come to the table to make agreements is a stall tactic. When you begin negotiating, always lay out your most desirable outcome first. You need to ask specifically for what you want. Many times, simply by setting the expectation early, the person you are persuading will accept that as the outcome he needs to work to and will work toward that end. If you start low, it is very difficult to raise the stakes later and gives you no room to make concessions. Part of effectively persuading during a negotiation is the give to receive. If you can make a concession first, it makes it much more likely and easy for the other person to make a concession of his own. If you're paying careful attention, you can use your concession to get him to give a bigger concession to show that he is, in fact, a more benevolent person. If you've set yourself up as an expert appropriately, many times stature can be carried into the negotiating room with you. This is especially important when you're negotiating with someone whom you did not convince in the first place. If you'll be negotiating with someone other than the person you've convinced, it's nearly always desirable to have the person in the room. The reason is very simple. He's made a commitment to you, and he's going to be hard-pressed to break it. He also has a big stake in the outcome because he's emotionally committed to having what you agreed upon. It also takes away a lot of the fakes and feints that other professionals negotiating the deal may try to throw in. If there was an agreement on a specific issue, questions about the agreement can be settled by asking the person who made it. Negotiation is also a patient game of questioning. The more information you can gather from the person whom you're negotiating with about her personal outcomes as well as her personal beliefs about the process, the more likely you will be to present an agreeable outcome. Whenever possible, link likability and familiarity to influence the person you're negotiating with. Get them to talk off-topic about issues, even as simple as the weather. Agreements that it's a beautiful or horrible day outside gives you something in common, a shared reality that you can build from. It seems very simplistic, but remember how the cultists work. They start with a core belief that most people have, an idea of savior and salvation, something you can both agree on. From there, it's simply a matter of building on your shared beliefs. There are 7 steps in the process of negotiation that you will want to follow to be most persuasive. Number 1, whenever possible, let the party with whom you are negotiating present her proposal first. Often you will find that she is offering more acceptable terms than you were willing to accept. The negotiation is finished before it starts. If she is not, it gives you an opportunity to see what her position is before you reveal yours. You have the opportunity to adjust your pitch before you give it. Number 2, test assumptions to see what is truly negotiable and what is not. If someone says, "We always do X," question it. Ask if there has ever been a case where they have not done it or where they would not do it. Try and find out if it is a hard and fast unbendable rule or something that could be different. Acknowledgement that something could be different means that it's not an absolute. Number 3. Once you've tested something, let it rest a while. Put it on the back burner and propose that you want to address other issues first. Get some agreement on inconsequential things. Come to an agreement on the things that you know you can agree on first. The more you can get the other parties used to agreeing, the more chance you'll have of finding a good solution that will work for all of you. Do not respond to emotional issues. In nearly every negotiation, someone will try to play hardball. Simply recognize it for what it is and continue the process. If he keeps pushing, address the issue and his behavior directly. Experts and authorities have nothing to prove. Address people's behavior and be willing to walk away if they are unreasonable. Understand that in every negotiation, there is the possibility that one of you will not agree and will walk. Do not be afraid to be that person in the appropriate circumstance. It can give you power later. Number 5. Lay your cards on the table. Before you can come to an agreement about what you will or will not do, everyone needs to lay their cards on the table. Often, this will break an impasse. If I understand you cannot meet my terms because it will bankrupt you, it would not make sense to have you start the project. We simply have to find another way. Number 6. Close the negotiation by reiterating what each party will do and documenting next steps. Once that is done, follow through on the steps. Be sure to get reassurance that everyone understands the negotiated outcome. Number 7. Finally, to seal the agreement, continue to persuade. When possible, have dinner or send some gift to the person or the people with whom you negotiated. First, by initiating the idea of giving to receive, you've given them something and expect in return that they will maintain their level of commitment. Second, it reinforces the idea that you're in a partnership and have mutual trust and concern for one another. Obviously, this is not something you can always do, particularly where the negotiation stems from a set of negative circumstances. But even then, you can acknowledge others in some meaningful way, even if that acknowledgement is to say you are sorry that things got to this level, but that you appreciate them for coming to agreement. This is not a time to be prideful. It's a time to ensure that your agreement sticks. Keep in mind throughout, like all persuasive situations, the most flexible person will persuade best. Be sure you develop rapport at some level and maintain it. Stay focused on the big picture, but pay attention to the small details. Keep score and use it only when necessary. If you've made a lot of concessions, point them out and make it known that you have given plenty and now you need something in return. When the negotiation comes to a successful conclusion, be happy. Negotiations can be a great deal of fun. They're much like a chess game, with all players doing their best for themselves. Once concluded, review what else you could have done to be more persuasive, because this time will not be the last time for you. And the more you know, the better you'll be the next time around. Chapter Review. There can be winners and losers in a negotiation, and both parties can still move forward. All of the persuasion tactics you have learned throughout the book should be applied during the negotiation. You must continue to persuade after the negotiation to be sure the agreement sticks. If you reach an impasse or strongly emotional period, allow for a cooling off period, giving calmer heads a chance to prevail, and give yourself time to regroup. Success questions. Do I have to win in every negotiation encounter in order to achieve my goals? If so, can I acknowledge and be happy with the wins I have had, even if I do not achieve my ideal outcome? Can I remain emotionless throughout the negotiation, even if the other party does not? Do I have the courage to walk away from the table if my needs cannot be met? Do I always make sure I'm negotiating with a decision maker or with a decision maker present? Chapter 18, Persuading the Masses Electronically. When I took office, only high-energy physicists had ever heard of what is called the World Wide Web. Now even my cat has its own page. President Bill Clinton. If you are to persuade effectively, you must learn to persuade electronically. In this case, I'm not talking about electronic broadcast media like radio and television. Rather, I'm talking about how you persuade using internet technologies. While many people have spoken about how to use the internet, very few people have truly explored how to use the internet to persuade. Fortunately, many of the same rules of traditional media apply, but there are some significant and noticeable differences of which you should be aware. I want to say one thing conclusively. Using the internet to persuade your audience, whether an audience of 1 or 1 million, is mandatory today. The internet is a predominant force in all of our lives. It gives us nearly instant access to information that might have taken us days or even weeks to find out in the past. That access makes it imperative that you're capable of persuading via the outlet people will turn to in order to verify the information you have given them or to find you in the first place. There are several technologies the best persuaders use on their websites to convey their messages. The first technology is the website itself. Your website needs to present an image that is congruent with your persona and the image of your company. I cannot tell you how many really impressive people I meet who look great, sound great, and have a powerful message. Then I go to their website to find more detailed information, and the site looks like it was designed by a rank amateur with no graphic design, writing, or persuasive ability. My first reaction to the person suddenly becomes incongruent with my reaction to the website. I have to then immediately question whether the person is as successful and knowledgeable as he had first appeared. People do judge you by your website. I'm neither a web designer nor a graphic artist, but I do know a few things about what makes websites persuasive. First, the site must be quick loading and easy to navigate. I should be able to find any information I want on the site within 2 or 3 clicks. Second, the site must be graphically pleasing. It should be laid out in a way that is conducive to reading. That means no wild blinking lights, funky fonts, or layouts that do not flow easily. Third, the site should have enough information to answer my questions and give me a way to easily reach you if I have more. It will also have a newsletter or other regular communication vehicle from you so that I can hear from you and develop a relationship. That should be set up using an autoresponder so anyone can sign up instantly and receive your information. It also helps you build a list of people who enjoy your work, people who become ideal persuasion candidates. Ideally, you'll have your contact phone number predominantly displayed on every page of the site. Fourth, the site will incorporate both audio and video in important areas. The great advantage of the internet is that it allows people to have the communication experience they want the way they want it. They can read, listen, or watch at their convenience based on their personal tastes. Audio and video will be two of your most powerful weapons in your campaign to persuade online. During my research for this audiobook, I had the opportunity to visit with Armand Morin, founder of The Big Seminar, unquestionably the best electronic persuasion seminar in the nation today. He is co-founder with Alex Mondozian and Rick Raditz of Audio Generator and Instant Video Generator. Armand told me how simply adding audio to his site in one key area improved the persuasive responsiveness by over 300%. According to Armand, specifically, telling people what to do audibly when they get to your site greatly increases the effectiveness of the site. In the example of increasing persuasive responsiveness by 300%, Armand simply had a small audio file that automatically played when anyone clicked on the website. The file said, "Before you go any further, fill in the box to the right with your name and primary email address so we can send you a valuable report about X." This demonstrates the power of the idea that people want to know what you do, but they do not want to spend a lot of time figuring it out. Web pages should also have headlines, like any other ad. The headline should tell me what information I can expect to find below it and why that information is important to me, or it should ask me a very compelling question that will force me to dig deeper for the answer. Keep your websites interesting and informative. People still consider the web an informational tool first and commerce tool second. If your site does a good job of providing information and persuading, you will have a winner. Closely related to websites are blogs. Blogs are weblogs that are able to be edited very easily by a user. Anyone who can use a word processor can write a blog. The best analogy is to think of a blog as a daily journal. A blog is a daily or weekly journal of your latest thoughts or ideas on a specific subject. I'm sure by now you've at least heard of a blog, if not read one, because of all the attention they received during the 2004 presidential election and the Iraq War. Blogs are powerful for several reasons, not the least of which is the fact that they are ranked higher in most major search engines than many web pages because of the relevance of keywords and the current nature of the content. I have a blog I use for my consulting practice. You can read it at www.boldapproach.com. Simply go there and click on the logo. That has ranked me much higher than my most significant competitors for keywords like advertising and marketing. Without that feature, I might have to pay $5 to $10 per click in a pay-per-click advertising search engine like Google to get a similar ranking. Blogs are also powerful because they give you an outlet for your ideas and a place where people can read and comment on them. Because blogs are beginning to be seen as a viable media outlet, the media are increasingly searching blogs for information and experts they can interview about every topic under the sun. Using a technology known as RSS, or Real Simple Syndication, people can subscribe to your blog and have it sent right to their desktop every time you post something new, or at whatever intervals they desire, so they can have your most current thoughts when you share them. Each of these web technologies does two things. It creates a following of people who likes you, and it gives them exclusive access to you in some way.